I am a huge believer of what you think about, you bring about.
Yeah, like having like vision boards or the theory of like the secret and whatnot.
My mind literally went to like thinking of like a sandwich. And I was like, it can't be that type of manifestation. It's got to be like long-term life goals.
Along comes Katina. Oh, I thought you might be hungry.
Oh, I'd be thinking about everything.
Welcome to Beyond the Screams. I'm joined by my usual co-host, Holly and Patrick.
Hello.
For the month of December, we are exploring tulpas. From Wikipedia, a tulpa is a concept in mysticism and the paranormal of a being or object which is created through spiritual or mental powers. It was adapted by 20th century theosophists from Tibetan sprolpa, which means emanation or manifestation. Modern practitioners use the term to refer to a type of willed imaginary friend which practitioners consider to be sentient and relatively autonomous. And who is the most popular imaginary friend in the month of December?
Good old Santa.
Oh, I was way off.
Oh, did you like superimpose the letters again, Satan?
Yeah,
It's very common.
I think he's the most popular year round, but I really thought we were doing like a David Cronenberg and it was like a bit, but it was not. I'm glad I did not say it.
We are talking about imaginary friends and manifestations, willing our thoughts into existence.
Did you guys ever have imaginary friends?
I did not. No. I did not. My sister did. Her imaginary friend, I don't remember if it was like a boy or a girl. I know it was like a little kid whose name was Chucka, which scared me. I'm like, oh, excuse me. Did you mean to say Chucky?
Here's Chucka. That's terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I was reading up on tulpas and seeing how they became prevalent in Western society, my goodness, it was just picked up by, if people know the term, bronies, usually males who are fans of My Little Pony. I don't know how it happened. There was some cross connection between like Reddit threads and something, and somehow tulpas became like this big topic in My Little Pony fandom. And I watched a couple videos on YouTube, and furries, you know, just like the personification of like animals, like very humanoid, animalistic creatures, and My Little Pony characters are fairly common amongst internet tulpamancers.
You know what? Bronies, furries, you guys do you. Furry costumes, very elaborately made.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my thing, you know, but more power to you. The bronies, though, the idea of the tulpa for the bronies was to manifest the characters from the show.
Yes.
Which is very, very fucking strange.
Yeah, I don't know if any of you, this is something that, like a term that I came across when I was in high school, like early college, the term waifu. Do any of you know
that?
Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I always call Katina. She's my waifu.
For any listeners who don't know, it's a term of endearment, but the term means like it's like a non-fictional character, usually like from anime or manga or something that, you know, somebody has like a crush on and they just imagine like, oh, this is going to be like my boyfriend, girlfriend, wife, husband, whatever. It errs on the feminine because, you know, guys have their fantasies.
Yeah.
So that's where waifu comes from. So now I was watching a video on making your waifus into tulpas. So I went down a huge rabbit hole.
You, dare I say, drank from the plasma pool.
I think I did.
You went beyond the veil.
Like, I learned a lot of stuff. I started out thinking, like, I don't know, like, the legitimacy of it. Like, with some people, it just seems like a coping mechanism. But then, like, the more I watch these videos, which we'll link in the show notes, I was like, okay, yeah, it's a coping mechanism for some people, I'm sure, but it's not dangerous. Like, people aren't, it's just a way to comfort yourself, to cope. I'm sure during COVID, the concept of tulpas on the internet kind of blew up. I'm very curious to look at that. Very interesting.
It's so funny to think about these Tibetan, what are they, monks? Whoever created the idea of a tulpa, I imagine didn't intend it, the idea to ever go into the world of bronies and anime and furries.
Yeah.
But here we are.
I'm pretty sure they were like, let's all pray and hold hands and put good vibes into the world.
Yeah, higher consciousness. Yeah.
Help people guide us on our journey through this crazy world that we live in.
Yeah, because one of the videos I was watching, they spoke with a psychologist and she was saying, you know, how is this different from the concept of, you know, having a spirit animal or having a spirit guide of some sort or having faith in God and praying and, you know, saying like you hear God's voice, you feel God's presence. It might seem ludicrous and like a wild out there idea, but the way that people relate to those other things that I just mentioned, it's basically the same thing. You know, nobody's hurting anybody.
Yeah, true.
Unless you're manifesting hurt or destruction on someone.
Yes, yeah. And that's where the brood comes in.
Yes, the brood.
Yes. So in this episode, we are going to review David Cronenberg's The Brood. This 1979 horror sci-fi flick follows a man who tries to uncover an unconventional psychologist's therapy techniques on his institutionalized wife amidst a series of brutal murders. Frank Carveth's wife, Nola, is under the care of Dr. Hal Raglan, who is the pioneer of a modern but controversial therapy called psychoplasmics. In Dr. Raglan's compound called Somafree, which, LOL, Soma, he pretty much makes his patients manifest their fears into physical anomalies on their bodies, be it the brood that Nola births or lymphosarcoma on a person's throat. Ew, gross.
Gross.
Yeah. Cool scarf game, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? This movie was written and directed by body horror master David Cronenberg. It stars Oliver Reed as Dr. Hal Raglan, Samantha Egger as Nola Carveth, and Art Hindle as Frank Carveth. The budget was around $1.5 million Canadian and grossed over $5 million. It got mixed reviews and is definitely a cult favorite at this point.
Yeah, definitely.
You can watch this movie on HBO Max as of end of November 2020. You could also rent or buy it from Amazon.
You can also buy it from Criterion Collection.
This movie.
This was the first time that I've seen it.
Same.
Same.
First time I've even heard of it.
I've heard of it. I just haven't seen it before. And every Saturday since, you know, everything has been locked down, a group of us from our Rocky cast, we get together online and we'll like watch a movie together and chit chat. This past weekend, I was like, oh, hey, we're going to be reviewing The Brood. Let's all watch it so I can, you know, start watching it. And then, of course, I fell asleep because I lied down. And that's what happens.
You have to watch a movie standing, Holly.
I know. I do. I really do. Even if I just sit and, like, kind of put my head back, I'm like, nope, I'm done. But one of my friends said that, you know, he's seen it before. And since becoming a father and having seen it, he views it very differently. Alan has never seen this. And the next day when I watched it again and I finished it, I was kind of surprised that he enjoyed it. And he was like, yeah, it kind of makes you want to wake up the kids and give them hugs, doesn't it? I was like, yeah, it really does.
I had a different experience with this movie. The first time I watched it, I came out of it and it was a very boring movie. The ending is great. Cronenberg comes out what you're expecting of a Cronenberg film. Mm-hmm. Gave it a second chance, watched it again. I enjoyed it more the second time, but it's still boring. It is still a boring film. It's 90 minutes long, and it could have been a 35-minute short, in my opinion. I will get into it, but maybe if I watch it again, I'll enjoy it more and more, and I continue watching. I'll force myself to like it eventually. It's just weird. This movie had everything going for it. phenomenal acting, a great writer, director.
It is kind of boring. Like, the body horror isn't as shocking until the end. Cronenberg has done some more shocking things in his films, but I am totally on your same page, Patrick. Like, the first time I watched it, I was like, okay, that was really weird, but very subdued compared to other Cronenberg films.
Yeah, I don't remember... I was reading an article review, and it had said that this movie, it seems like it's the bridge between early Cronenberg and later things that have, I don't know, like more layers to it, you know, like The Fly. Like, we spent hours talking about that, and, you know, and more production too.
Yeah, it's definitely like one of his first bigger budget movies. I think it's the most, weirdly to say, the most real, one of the most realistic movies he's done. And I think his thought process of this was not so much of the body horror, and obviously he put it in there because he loves that shit, but it was more trauma. Everything was focused around trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Patrick, why don't you tell us about the inspiration of this movie?
Oh, fucking wild. This movie is loosely based off Cronenberg himself. His first wife, Margaret Hidson?
Wow.
His first wife, Margaret, which that's my mom's name. Hey, Mom. Took their daughter, Cassandra, and joined a cult in California. He eventually just flew to California and walked into the cult, grabbed his daughter, and walked out, which is... just wild. Trying to find information on that whole story is kind of hard. You just kind of get little bits and pieces. But this movie kind of comes about the trauma that it caused his daughter and himself with his ex-wife and stuff. Obviously, it's just kind of taken from bits and pieces of his actual life. And that's why I think it's also more one of the more realistic movies he's done. Besides The Fly, super realistic.
Another article I was reading, it was Pop Matters. The author, Brent McKnight, of that article, he said, "The Brood is the stuff of nightmares on every level, the recurring kind that stick with you and infect the rest of your day long after you wake up." That statement is very true, and that it's because of the realism combined with the, you know, grotesque body horror and the very sensitive nature of, you know, having children. I think having children in the center of a story like this, you know, whether or not you have kids, you enjoy kids, whatever, I think, you know, just that sense of innocence being corrupted, that's something that people can feel uncomfortable with.
Yeah.
And the story also highlights divorce and the trauma of divorce.
Yeah, the trauma of divorce and how it affects, sometimes will affect one side way more than the other side. Mm-hmm. Obviously, yeah. Nola in this movie is being affected by, you know, greatly, where Frank is just trying to do what's best for the daughter, which I imagine is similar to Cronenberg's real life.
Mm-hmm.
The lady who played Nola, Samantha Egger, she was cast in this role because Cronenberg thought she looked like his ex-wife, which I found interesting and kind of a weird thing to do. But it's Cronenberg, so you do you, man.
Yeah.
I read so many articles about this movie praising it, and I've watched so many videos praising this movie, and there is a lot that goes for this to be praised. There's a lot that really, I would say, shaped Cronenberg and helped Cronenberg break out. Like, even Martin Scorsese, after he watched this movie, was like, "I'm scared to meet that guy." I don't see it in this film.
Huh. Well, the reason why we're talking about this is because the characters, the patients who are receiving this quote-unquote therapy, they're manifesting physical things on their bodies. I don't know about you guys, but if I get stressed out, and if it's like a mental stress, I will literally break out on the upper right of my head.
Whoa, me too. That exact same spot, the upper right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think because it is so relatable and it's so realistic that why couldn't something, you know, manifest into an exo-womb and little creatures are created?
Murderous,
you know,
small,
like, it's
children.
Just, it's taking something that actually exists and pushing it just a little bit further.
Yeah, because all different kinds of things happen to your body when you're under extreme stress, like breakouts, you gain weight, you know, you retain belly fat. Maybe less noticeable things, like you don't sleep as well, your appetite is affected, but that's all manifested from some kind of stress or trauma that isn't being dealt with.
And that's where I think the movie shines. I think that's what the movie does extremely well. Getting to these points is where the movie fails. I dig a slow burn, but when the wick is not lit and you're just staring at a candle, you just get bored. Between the first death to the next one and the one after, everything was just very stale. I already knew what was happening, and I'm just watching like something happen over and over again that I already know where it's going to go. And that's where the movie killed itself. But The whole manifestation on the bodies and the psychologist, the wife, it was so good. That aspect was phenomenal.
For sure.
Yeah. I want to make one more note before we get into the movie. I just want to say in 2006, the Chicago Film Critics Association named it the 88th scariest film of all time.
Oh, Chicago.
Hey. We give you Malort. You shut it.
88? That seems pretty high.
Really? Yeah, top 100 scariest film of all time? Like, really?
Maybe they fell asleep and woke up in like a different movie. I just thought it was this.
That could have been me.
But yeah.
You'd be grateful for what we give you.
Not this one.
Any other notes on production worth mentioning?
Samantha Egger, all her scenes, her entire time on set was 4 days.
Wow.
I watched the making of, where it only has a few people that were on the crew in the movie. This goes for Cronenberg pretty much all his films. He's always pretty much most of the time on budget, works with a very small, tight-knit crew that worship him, and gets things done quickly.
Samantha Eggers was honored to be part of this movie. I mean, she compared her role to a Shakespearean character. There's lots of people who really, really respect him and would do anything to work with
him. You know what's funny about her, though? She was also a little weirded out being on set because her and Oliver Reed had a fling in the past. He's Mr. Bad Boy alcoholic. I guess he tried to rekindle things when she was there.
Maybe that's why she was only there for 4 days. She's like, hey, let's keep it to a minimum.
No, she was filming something else back in London. I guess they were on a tight schedule and he was just like, yeah, come on down. I'm sure they had other reshoots and she came down for like the rap party and whatnot, but 4 days is crazy. I mean, she never really leaves a room. So I guess it's kind of like...
But all that makeup and everything, like the prosthetics, that has to eat up a lot of time to put on.
Yeah, and Holly, who was the guy that did the prosthetics?
Oh, Rick Baker did the prosthetic application. If people are not familiar with that name, he did special effects for The Howling. He was a consultant. He did effects for An American Werewolf in London, Videodrome, Michael Jackson's Thriller, Harry and the Hendersons, which
Hell yeah.
is a big favorite of mine, Gorillas in the Mist, Nutty Professor, Frighteners, Men in Black, a ton of things. His name is all over. It's everywhere.
But he wasn't the main person.
No, he was not. But he did the applications.
Him and Cronenberg had issues because I forget the main guy. He was old school. I'm talking, worked on Wizard of Oz and stuff like that. But where Rick Baker and Cronenberg wanted to use more plastic kind of stuff, he was still using wax. And apparently there was like a lot of issues on production just using wax, with it melting or freezing to people's skin or...
Yeah, wax, like the mortician's wax.
Yeah.
I understand the want to work with it because it's malleable and you could adhere it and use makeup to make it look that skin tone is just easy to use. But yeah, I could see it easily like melting and just not being fun to work with.
And Cronenberg also, you know, kind of thought it was too old school at the same time.
Yeah.
Also the first movie with him and Howard Shore, which he does a lot of Cronenberg's movies.
Yeah, that music.
Cool. Well, should we get into it?
Yeah, let's get into it.
Mm-hmm.
The movie opens with a theatrical therapy session with Dr. Raglan and a patient named Mike. The patient is dealing with daddy issues, and at the conclusion of this performance, Mike ends up with weird lesions on his body. I like that Cronenberg wasted no time shocking us with a gross body situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, at first when I saw that, Again, this was another article I was reading that, you know, it's not very apparent at first, like what's going on. And you can think that it's like some kind of play or something, just a scene between two people. Mm-hmm. What this article said, I experienced like every step of the way. I'm like, oh, yes, is this a play? Is this a scene? And then I was like, wait, no, this seems too, I don't know, just the way that lines are being spoken. I was like, this is too deep to be just a play. I think they're actually having like a therapy session. And then it did cut to the audience. But then when Mike had taken off his shirt, I thought those were like self-injury marks, like burns. I was like, yeah, like how do you get them all over his back and everything? My brain was not in that mode of like, yeah, this is like something that's manifesting yet. I was still like, you know, this, we're setting this up. This is our psychologist. He's a little unconventional maybe for the times, but, you know, people open up to him. So yeah, my very little knowledge going into this, I was not seeing the manifestation part yet.
Yeah. I mean, this is like 2 minutes into the movie.
Yeah.
It's like a hell of a way to open the movie.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah. Also, the theatrics of new age therapy and self-help and stuff like that, especially since it was like booming in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was kind of all like a show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird to see it and like see the merits of like this kind of therapy, but also to be put on like it is a play. It's like, it seems like the wrong people can just prey into people and use something good and scientific that has proven results and just manipulate and use people and, you know, get what they want from them.
Like most cults.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
In the audience is our protagonist, Frank, who's at the compound to pick up his daughter, Candace, aka Candy, who spends the weekends with her mom, even though the wife is supposed to be in isolation as part of her therapy. While Frank is bathing Candy back at his home, he sees bruises and bite marks all over her back. Frank returns to Soma Free to demand that Candy no longer sees her mom and argues about the legitimacy of Nola's treatment. Frank then raps with a lawyer about preventing Candy from having to see her mom on weekends because it's quote-unquote crawling with crazies and it's no place for a kid. The lawyer recommends that he be a mensch, aka play nights, because the law believes in motherhood and Frank could lose complete custody. So this is really interesting. I wasn't sure if they were making a comment on dad rights versus mom rights in the eyes of the law, because they kind of were like, well, the law is always going to side with the mother, even though she's in an institution.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was kind of shining light on that, since I imagine in real life, Cronenberg probably had a battle with his ex-wife over their daughter. And, you know, in my eyes, whoever's going to raise the child better should get custody. Or if they both are willing and in the right state of mind and financially able, then split it so the child has access to both parents.
Yeah, unfortunately, it doesn't matter if you're mom or dad. It matters whether or not you're a fit parent. And clearly, Frank has seen that his daughter is not in a proper environment. If she has bruises, she's possibly being abused. So clearly, her mother is not fit. She is not in a fit environment.
But also, you know, there's a lot of points where in the movie where I was like, is Frank finally going to show some real emotion here? And he just doesn't. There's a lot of points I was like, I'm waiting for some, you're like, your face to change. I need some more emotion here, Frank. You see your daughter getting beat and it's just like, he wasn't believable. He wasn't that believable sometimes.
When I saw that, like that in that moment when he's bathing Candy, like I had that moment of like my heart sank into my stomach. And like when I realized like what was going on, I was like, oh, no. And then he like his face, I was like, that's a very Fox Mulder face for the situation.
Do I want to believe?
It's like I make this face when I panic.
Yes. Yes, you know, now that you guys mentioned that, yeah, he kind of was a flat character.
Extremely flat. He has the exact same hair as me, though. If I was to cut my hair like that, it'd be exactly the same. That's all I kept thinking about when I saw him. I was like, I used to have that haircut.
All right, next Halloween, we're doing a group Halloween costume.
I will go as Paper Frank, and you guys go as the little people.
Part of the brood.
We get more exposition and drama when Frank picks up Candy from school and her teacher, Miss Mayer, comments that they need to chat about Candy. And then we meet Nola's mom, who has a constant half-full glass of J&B and laments to Frank about being blamed for everything, aka why Nola is in therapy. Apparently, when Nola was young, she would randomly wake up with big, ugly bumps and have to go to the hospital, and the mom has no idea how she got them. It's definitely a case of mommy blacked out and abused her child.
Yeah. Yeah.
And child wants to not remember it, so we'll block out those memories.
Old J&B came over.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my god, when she said to Candy, let me just go get a refill.
Does she still have a glass?
Yeah. Right? I was like, Jesus, woman.
Oh. Yeah. I love the dialogue that she says, 30 seconds after you're born, you have a past. And 60 seconds after that, you start to lie to yourself about it.
That is a beautiful sentence.
Yeah.
I was like, dang, Cronenberg, you are hitting hard,
right?
And deep.
Yeah.
You know, you learn real quick, okay, you're an alcoholic and you're talking about how, you know, hard it is to be a parent because, you know, the kid just blames you for everything. But then you're like, oh, but there's a reason.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, she has this wonderful line about lying to yourself about it, you know, not wanting to come to terms with trauma. I mean, we don't know why the mom's an alcoholic other than she divorced her husband and the husband was never around, which we meet Grandpa Bart. It's a super relatable line.
Yeah.
You know, how many things have we tried to forget?
Yeah. And, you know, in mental health, you know, you see stuff like alcoholism, you know, abuse, like that stuff is cyclical. It's generational. And mm-hmm. What you just said, we don't know her history, you know, like were her parents like this? And she learned to stuff down those emotions. And, you know, with the times, like just put on a happy face and keep up your appearances, that trickles down. It's really sad.
I totally agree. Like, it is generational, and it's not till recently that being open about your emotions and being open about going to therapy and stuff like that, that's a new thing.
Yes.
Like, usually if you went to therapy, you hid it. You hid it from people and stuff like that. I imagine her being, I don't know, this came out in 78. Her mom probably went through a ton of just shit from her dad coming back from any of those wars. And
yeah.
And now we're looking deep into a very character that was on screen for maybe 10 minutes. But
as far as, you know, this familial context of, you know, manifestation and like a manifestation of your pain and trauma, it's quite relevant to dive deeper into her character.
Yeah. Well, while Candy is hanging with her grandma, Nola is having a therapy session with Dr. Raglan, where she is reliving her mom's abuse. Dr. Raglan tells Nola to go all the way to the end. In the next scene, we see something is wreaking havoc in the grandma's kitchen, pushing everything off the shelves. It's like the most annoying cat in the world is there and just knocking everything over.
Or my children.
The grandma goes in to investigate / refill her J&B, and she is attacked by a little person in a cute snow jacket. Poor Candy walks in and sees her dead and the attacker. But when the cops show up, she was in a deep sleep and doesn't remember anything.
Much like her mom.
Yep.
Who doesn't remember her bruises.
Mm-hmm. In the police station, a police psychologist talks to Frank about his daughter's state and mentions that she could have, quote, a serious breakdown if she doesn't come to terms with what she experienced. You see, these things tend to express themselves in one way or another. I've seen 5-year-olds like your daughter with ulcers as bad as any middle-aged businessman. So here we have stress, anxiety, anger manifesting as a physical body situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly what I was saying earlier. Stress can manifest in all kinds of physical ways. Have either of you two seen the movie Little Man Tate? It's with Jodie Foster.
I have not.
And Diane Wiest is in it. She's from Edward Scissorhands, the mom. It's a really cute movie. It's a 90s movie. It's about, you remember one of the kids in Halloween H2O? The one who had he was a friend in the school. He had the bigger nose.
Yes.
He was one of the students that stayed behind. He was the little boy in that movie, which also Harry Connick Jr. was in, and he looks quite tasty. But anyway, in that movie, the character, Tate, his mom is Jodie Foster, and she just describes him as this very, not like other kids, and just very concerned about outside things. And one of the things that he fixated on as a child was global warming. Ha ha. We can still worry about that one. And, he was so worried about it that he would get ulcers. And, he had to, eat special food and, have protein shakes because he couldn't eat properly because of his ulcers. I'm such a big proponent of, just talk to anybody if you deem it necessary, do therapy with a licensed clinician. But, just talk to anybody about, stress or anxiety that you're experiencing, because that stuff that will eat away at you.
Yeah, exactly like this police psychologist said, these things tend to express themselves in one way or another. Yep. There's no sense in repressing it because it's going to manifest in some way.
Mm-hmm.
We have another therapy session with Nola where she thinks she's talking to her daddy, but it's Dr. Raglan. And she's upset that he never defended her or helped her with her mom's abuse. She also expresses concern that her husband is planning to take Candy away from her. Foreshadow. These sessions that Dr. Raglan has, where he's pretty much just gaslighting his patients.
Not a good therapy method.
No, it's very frustrating to watch. Especially as somebody who, again, I'm going to say it over and over, not a therapist in any way, shape, or form, but I work in an office full of them. And to see somebody manipulate patients like he does, I'm like, oh my goodness. I want to tear my face off.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like, this person is helping me. And it's like, no. They are manipulating you for their own hidden agenda.
Yep.
Usually profit.
Yeah. Frank goes to see an ex-patient of Dr. Raglan, Jan Hartog, which I love a dude named Jan. What? Who is pursuing a lawsuit against Dr. Raglan because he experienced physiological damage. Jan has lymphosarcoma that's spreading because Raglan encouraged his body to revolt against him. This character was so interesting.
Yeah.
This is such a wacky, kind of funny scene.
Yeah, he reminded me of Christoph Waltz.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah, he's such an interesting character. Your introduction with him when he's rolling around on the ground and then he's talking about your lymphatic system. One of the things that I do at least weekly is Kundalini yoga. It's meditative and everything. And there's a lot of emphasis on spinal things because your spine holds all of the things that send information to all of your nerves that, of course, we all know sends information all over your body. So yes, your lymphatic system is extremely important. And I saw him, I was like, oh, I want to be friends with you.
Yeah, I also want his Adidas tracksuit.
Again, cool scarf game.
Yeah. In this scene, he exposes he has all these cancerous lymph nodes, and I guess it's spreading all over his body. So that was another, honestly, subdued body horror reveal.
It was. I wasn't expecting it. And also, when I saw it, I don't know if it was just me, but I also couldn't see it very well for what it was. I couldn't see the detail in it. Because of that, I was also okay, yeah, that's weird. Something weird is happening. I think it was the lack of detail that made it kind of okay, rather than an oh my god, that's weird.
Yeah, it kind of looked like what chickens or turkeys have underneath their beaks, but like times 10.
Yeah, it looked very strange.
Like gathered up into like a located spot.
I would honestly not even wear a scarf, though. I'd let it just like hang.
Just waddle around. Waka waka.
So Nola's dad comes into town for the grandma's funeral, and he has a drinking problem too.
Shocker.
The granddad ends up at the grandma's house, where he's depressed as hell and finishing off a bottle of Brown Town. Grandpa Barton calls Frank, who was having that meeting slash dinner with Candy's teacher, to join him in going up to Soma Free to kick their ass, because the dad tried to go talk to Nola, but Dr. Ragland was like, you can't talk to her. She's in isolation for intensive therapy. And her dad was like, I'm sorry, sir. Her mom died, and I need to tell her you're a psychopath.
Yeah, I think that just goes back to the cult mentality. No contact from the outside world and all that. Mm-hmm. Just bringing it into the script.
Yeah. Well, Frank is able to go pick up his drunk father-in-law as the teacher stays behind to babysit Candy.
He asks a lot from this teacher.
Well, I'm just saying she kind of volunteered herself to babysit because she was like, oh, I guess I've been recruited for babysitting. It's like, okay,
yeah.
I'm sorry. The way you said that, you just accepted it.
Also, this was another like part of the movie I had a problem with because her character was like, as developed as Frank was, and just like nothing going on, and this weird kind of basic love interest.
I didn't mind that because of what she meant to the story.
Like a real motherly figure for Candy?
No, well, yes. I mean, that was sad. Yeah, when she was telling Frank, like, this, as soon as Candy got me alone, she was playing mother and daughter with me, and that broke my heart. But, you know, what the teacher meant to the story in terms of Nola's manifestations and like her insecurities and diving deeper into her character, I didn't mind the teacher being very one-dimensional.
Yeah, I mean, she pretty much was there to say, Nola needs a mother, and I'm not mm-hmm. her mother figure.
Yeah.
It just took them 20 minutes of her on screen to say any of that.
Yeah. Well, during dinner, Frank comments to the teacher about getting involved with a woman who married you for your sanity, hoping it would rub off. Instead, it started to work the other way. I was like, dang, shots fired, Cronenberg.
Right? That cuts deep.
Also, as Grandpa Bart is walking through the murder scene of his late wife's house, he gets attacked by a little person. These full-fledged little kid snow gear, snowsuits? Wait, what?
You know what? It just...
That wasn't scary.
I think it made it creepier. No, I think it made it creepier because I remember and have pictures of me in those same fucking snowsuits, and they were a damn nightmare.
I grew up in Southern California in Las Vegas, so I was never a snowsuit like that.
I have pictures of me in something exactly like that, and it was horrible.
See, I'm with Steph. I don't think it was scary. Their faces were scary, but I don't think I know the outfits are supposed to mimic Candy and this weird, also kind of bringing it back, like this kind of cultish idea of everyone needs to wear and look the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I thought about that the second time I watched it. But I don't think it was scary. And I don't think Chicago should have rated this the 88th scariest movie of all time.
I wonder if it's creepier to people who have grown up. It's like, all right, it's time, like, break out the snowsuits.
I would agree with you if this movie was more elemental, like it was due to weather. People are dying because of weather.
Uh-huh.
It was just kids in snowsuits, though.
Okay. I'm gonna come to your door one day and I'm gonna be in a snowsuit and you're gonna crap your pants.
I don't know. I lived in those snowsuits and they're not scary.
What if you have to pee? They're terrifying.
I don't know. They're just, it's, I don't know. I mean, they're snowsuits. They're the gateway to playing in snow and drinking hot chocolate. Like, I found so much joy.
The gateway to playing in the snow. I love that.
Okay, you had to like put that on, and then you had sledding and like just playing in snow, which
Oh man,
I love and miss.
No, as soon as the kids are like, "Oh, there's snow outside," I'm like, "Oh yeah, but you're gonna get all wet and cold, and then you're not gonna be able to warm up. Like, let's just stay in the house. It's fine."
I rolled around in dirt as a kid because we used to live, obviously, in the desert. We used to take old campaign signs that they would leave out and about, and we'd sled down just like dirt hills with them. Or if we'd wait for the golf courses sprinkling system to go on, and we'd do that. Good times.
Nice. Well, Frank shows up to see the little person. This little person throws a crystal ball at like 90 miles an hour, but yeah. dies shortly after their encounter. I mean, when that little person threw that ball and it like went through the wall, I was like, dang.
Me too. I said, whoa, you can have a career in baseball. That was a throw.
The brood, they weren't scary. And when they were attacking people, I was like, I don't know. Can't you just fight them off? But that one scene where the one throws the ball, that was like,
yeah,
scary.
Like you can kind of see their force that they have. And then,
yeah, their strength at that point.
Yeah. And then, you know, as the movie goes on, seeing like more and more, you're like, oh shit. Yeah, that is scary.
The rage is increasing in her. So it's like their strength is increasing.
Mm-hmm.
So we get an autopsy explanation of this little person, which I thought was super cool. You know, the one that Frank encountered dies. So cut to an autopsy scene and the police who's like, oh, I guess it was just a deformed child that was locked up in the attic. But the autopsy scene, which is in a shade of purple, which was weird.
Yeah, I felt like I was watching Ancient Aliens and someone was going to come on and be like, the CIA has been hiding these alien bodies for years.
Yeah. Yeah, so we get a rundown of the brood as cleft palate, they don't have sexual organs, there's a little sack in the back between the shoulder blades that acts as like a gas tank, and when it's empty, that person dies, and it doesn't have a belly button.
I thought their face prosthetic was creepy. Overall, their creepiness comes from them being manifested. Other than that, they're not that scary.
I think they're off-putting.
Yeah.
But yes, once you finally realize what they actually are, what they represent, then they become scary.
I mean, I wouldn't want one under my bed. I'll say that.
No.
If one crawled out from under my bed as I just walked into my room, or if I walked in my kitchen, it was like sitting on my fridge. I mean, that is scary. That's frightening.
That snowsuit would scare me. Like, oh no, do I have to wear
it? I'd be like, we're in Texas. It's fucking 75 degrees in December. Why are you in a snowsuit?
I would be like, wait, where's the snow? Let's go. Okay, meanwhile, Nola calls Frank's house and the teacher answers, uh-oh. Nola accuses the teacher that their private PTA meeting is killing their family.
I mean, she is in therapy and, I mean, maybe she thinks that, you know, there's a chance to a happy family. So, just putting that out there. Yeah, this poor teacher, like, she was an unfortunate bystander and everything and, yeah, suffered the wrath of what unchecked stress and anxiety and insecurities can manifest.
Yeah, they did her wrong. The mom, Nola, is just like, at this point, she's in such a strange mental state where I feel like as she progresses, she breaks, and that's when she becomes normal again, is because she breaks and she starts acting like more peaceful, but it's really just because she's like completely broken at this point, at that point.
Yeah, that's a scary moment to witness. It's that, I guess, acceptance or complacency with having had a mental break.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't like that Nola was kind of written as like a stereotypical woman who's just jumping to conclusions. You know, she's not allowed to feel her emotions because she's manifesting little murderous people.
The experience he went through with his ex-wife put such a sour taste in his mouth that he made a movie where, obviously, the movie we're talking about now. But yeah, I could definitely see like that experience putting a weird taste. I mean, imagine like being with someone and that happening. where you have to go and steal your daughter back because a crazy madman isolated your significant other and turned them so against you, and they try to turn your daughter, and you have to fight for it. Like, yeah, you're going to be a little overprotective and a little off-put by a lot of things for a while.
Nobody should have to go through that.
I mean, this movie came out in 78, and I think he did that in, like, 76. So it's recent. It's a recent thing.
Well, in another therapy session, Nola is chatting with Dr. Ragland about her relationship, and the doc is like, divorce Frank, marry me. Ew, such a creep. Nola, at this point, sounds level-headed, telling the doc to stop poisoning Frank against her and that he would help her if the doc would just leave him alone.
This is her breaking point, right? This is where she breaks,
yeah,
where she's just,
yeah,
like, I'm in my own world now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't blame Nola. Like, she has this marriage that is extremely rocky. She kind of gets to have a life with her daughter. Like, it's in isolation in, like, a hospital. So, like, you know, what kind of relationship is that? And then somebody who should have no conflict of interest, somebody who is taking care of you, is like, oh, hey, just marry me. I'm not surprised. She's like, oh, okay, well, I guess I can't trust anybody. And then just, like, breaks. Everybody that she is supposed to trust is seemingly out to get her in some way.
You know what I thought about this whole scene when he was like, well, you should marry me? I keep going back to cults, but there is always a turning point where the leader of the cult just starts sleeping with everyone. That's what I thought about this, was just like, leave your husbands, I am the chosen one kind of mentality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. At this point, I wasn't sure who the villain was in the movie, and then this happens and you're like, oh, well, this guy's definitely the villain because he's taken advantage of his patients, especially Nola.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's driving her to unconsciously kill people who have done her wrong. So Frank returns home and relieves the teacher of her babysitting duties. The teacher's like, your life is too complicated for me. Ew. See you at the next open house or whatever. Frank has a touching scene with Candy where he soothes her worries about the little person murderer because it's lying dead on a table. Nothing to worry about.
It's dead.
I was so shocked that he was just like, oh yeah, that thing that you experienced, it's dead. It's fine. Like, any parent I know, yeah, they'd be like, oh no, you didn't see anything. Like, they would have squashed that. But I was like, oh, I don't know. I don't know how to feel about this, if that would make me feel better or worse. Just saying like, oh no, it's dead. It's fine. I saw it. It's dead.
This whole scene really solidified that Frank was just like a very non-emotional actor.
Okay. I can see that.
Yeah. Back at the Soma Free Ranch, Dr. Ragland tells his assistant to evacuate the compound because shit is about to go down, but do it gently. I was like, where are these folks going? Well, Daddy Issues Mike ends up at Jan's hangout, where he tells Frank about Queen Bee Nola is going to be the one to prove that psychoplasmics is the ultimate therapeutic device. Oh, and he wants to be alone with your wife.
BTW. Yeah.
Do you have anything to eat? Yeah. He wants to be alone with your wife.
I believe he calls her like the chosen one, and you know, she's like the favorite because she is doing what, you know, nobody else has seemingly that we know of. Like, you know, we see all these like little lesions and like, you know, like the neck,
yeah,
thing and everything, but nothing as pronounced as what Nola is able to do.
Yeah. Well, the brood sneak into the school, kill the teacher, and kidnap Candy, all while Frank is outside chatting up a mom.
This scene made me laugh so hard because those kids, when they come in the classroom, all I could think of was like, hey, Vinny, hey, Tony, go get them. Go get that girl. Let's get out of here. Let's break some ankles. They look like fucking mob members going in and just like, hey, you're coming with us. It was so silly. It was just silly.
Yeah.
I was very focused on, yeah, just like being a mom. I'm like, oh my God, the trauma that these kids just went through and the amount of therapy that it's going to take to help them through this, I was like, my heart just breaks. And I think this is one of the things, like, where my friend was like, seeing this after becoming a parent, you just watch it a little differently.
I mean, these kids are all really good actors, looking horrified. And fortunately, one of the kids runs out for help, and Frank comes in and sees the dead, bloody teacher. Frank then takes a kid's drawing and puts it over her face. And immediately burst out laughing because it says on it in crayon, "We planted pumpkin seeds."
I know. And, you know, to me, that was equal parts, like, just heartbreaking to see this little kid's, like, innocence and, like, you know, all the stuff that they're learning and this new world exposed to them, like, on paper, because I'm experiencing that with Victor right now. Like, he's learning how to write, and I see him writing phonetically. And so I'm like, oh my God, seeing how your brain works, it's so amazing and it's beautiful. I'm so proud of you. And then to see that, like, just pulled over, like, their dead teacher's face, like, with this pool of blood around her, I was equal parts amused and just heartbroken. Like, the mom in me, I was like, oh my God, like, whose artwork is that? Like, whose kid is going to be like, oh, this is mine, and we put it over my dead teacher's face? And then just me being me, I'm like, oh yeah, that's my face.
I don't know, like, this is the point in the movie where, to me, it starts picking up to be much better, but, like, this whole scene was just outrageous. It's not scary to me at all, it was just funny. So, like you said, Steph, as soon as he slowly slides the paper over her face, I laughed, I rewound it, and watched it again.
I know a few people in my life who would do that, and I love them so much more for it.
Also, once again, no emotions whatsoever.
Yeah, he's just, like, not even fazed by anything going on. He's just like, oh, I just need to take care of business. Yeah. He seems frustrated more than sad or scared or anything.
Yeah.
He's just like, I have to build a house, and these people want to move in way before then we're going to be done. That's my priority right now.
I got a deadline to hit.
The situation with Nola and Candy, I don't have time for this. Let's just, like, figure this out and move on. Well, Nola wakes up from a nice nap where she somehow feels a sense of relief about her beef with the teacher. Then we have Frank looking for Candy, doesn't know where she could be, and it's not until Daddy Issues Mike shows up and tells him all about the kids that Nola is taking care of. So Frank drives to Somafree, where Dr. Raglan is like, what? But then realizes that the brood have been killing while Nola was in her therapy sessions, and tells Frank that the brood are the literal children of Nola's rage / extensions of her emotions. Frank needs to calmly talk to Nola as he quietly gets Candy from the brood hangout. At this point, I was like, okay, when is this doctor, when did he all of a sudden get a conscience? Yeah. And how long has this brood been around? And it's not until now that Dr. Raglan is like, okay, this is getting out of hand and I need to stop this.
I mean, by this point, you see how many brood there are, and she's got to be birthing, like, I don't know, three a day.
Yeah, how much therapy is she going through? how fast do they gestate? Oh.
Yeah, also, are they born with ski suits, or is someone supplying them with little ski suits?
I just had a question. A very interesting question that I don't think any of us can answer, but I wonder if the situational stressor dictates how quickly one of them gestates.
I wish I knew.
Yeah. Like, if it's something that, like, you know, if there weren't these present, let's say, roadblocks, like the teacher, you know, is that something that manifested really quickly? Or if she were going through therapy thinking of, you know, something that wasn't as traumatizing for her, but still something she needed to work through, would it be more slow to manifest, or is it all the same? Just curious. Just a thing.
What if, like,
to put out there,
she also, instead of just manifesting her rage, what if she also manifested, like, sadness and happiness, and so you just had, like, an array of different broods that were just, like, characters at this point?
That's too many kids.
The brood in this corner is the sad one. It's just crying. Then we got the angry ones are beating everyone up, and then the happy ones are just, you know, dancing around.
Oh, man.
Just mix them up for funsies. Go have fun, kids.
They all still murder, though. All of them still murder.
That is a very insightful statement, and also manifestation can go both ways. You can manifest negative things, but you can certainly manifest positive things.
Yeah, absolutely.
But what if, like, what you're thinking about you think is positive, but is not positive, and is a bad thing?
Manifestation is in the mind of the manifester. So the next scene is the scene that makes this movie. Frank is chatting with Nola about getting back together and supporting her, and Nola's kind of buying it. And during this convo, there are clips of Dr. Raglan in the Brood hangout, which is like a cute bunk bed situation in like the attic,
right?
Or whatever.
It looks like camp. I was like, I want to hang out there.
Did Dr. Raglan and his assistant like buy bunk beds for these, you know, for this brood and like get sheets and everything? Like,
they got bunk beds and snowsuits were going on sale at Costco, so they just bought in bulk and we're like, hey, we're ready.
Are they born? And then he's just like, let me just show you to your room, here's your outfits, you must wear them at all times.
How quickly they grow, like, just because there
are a lot of logistics with this brew that had me thinking about
David Cronenberg. I have questions.
So Nola, in this conversation with Frank, she's like, yo, some strange stuff has been happening to me. I'm not sure people from my old life can handle it. And Frank is like, girl, I'm ready. Whatever it is, make me a part of it. At this point, Nola's like, Frank is not ready. So she's like, do you want to be a part of this? Because look.
Are you ready for me, Frank? I seem to be a very special person. I'm in the middle of a strange adventure.
I want to go with you wherever you go.
Do you?
Yes.
Then look!
And Nola whips her arms up in her white nightgown and reveals her exo-womb side stomach sack situation where she has been birthing the brood.
Yeah, they're like all attached to these like little bumps all over her bodies.
Oh, God, that was such a good scene. And she looked like Carrie's mom.
Yeah.
Like, when she's just, like, floating, like, through the hall, just, like, walking toward Carrie. I was like, oh, my God, this is so visually beautiful.
All those things attached to her were just condoms filled with various things.
Yeah, condoms are very stretchy, but remember, people, practice safe sex. Don't put one on top of the other. They will rub and break. So yeah, PSA, don't do that.
This makeup looked great, though, on her.
And this actress, Nola, Samantha Egger, she got into it. She, like, bites this sack, pulls out a brood fetus, licks it.
That was her idea.
Oh, God, I love that.
She said that she grew up on a farm with lots of animals, and she would watch how other, like, animals gave birth, so she thought she would do that.
I feel like Nola is the representation of that primal instinct of, this is what I know to do. And, like, you know, like the actress said, she grew up on farms, and you see, like, cows licking calves all the time, like, just licking that amniotic stuff off of them and cleaning them. And I want to say, as I don't think violent is the right word, but that's what I'm going to go with, as violent as it was, like, what she was doing, it was still very motherly and primal. And it was, you know, like I said, like what my friend said, you know, having had kids and seeing this movie, see it in a totally different way.
Do you think the brood crawl, instead of being placed on the mother, they go straight for the ski suit?
You just said, like, you're cradling a ski suit. Come on, child, come on. You can do it. Get your little arms in there.
So anyway, Nola gets into it, and she's like, no, I disgust you. You came here to take our daughter away. At which point, the brood starts to attack Dr. Raglan, where they end up killing him. Frank ends up strangling Nola because she threatens to kill Candy before he could ever take her away from him. That threat turns into the brood attacking Candy, who ends up in a closet screaming for her life.
Cool little note about that scene. All the broods were played by little gymnasts, like kid gymnasts, and their parents are the ones who were throwing them onto Oliver Reed.
That's really awesome.
Well, Frank kills Nola, which in turn kills the brood.
Another interesting fact about this scene was David Cronenberg said, "Watching Nola be strangled was oddly satisfying."
No shit, Cronenberg.
If you hire someone that looks similar to your ex-wife, and you write a movie about your ex-wife, and then you watch her get strangled.
I'm sure he worked out and, worked out some demons. He avoided making his own, evil tulpa. So
the brood is a tulpa.
Yes.
For David Cronenberg.
Okay,
manifested this. Well, Frank finds a traumatized Candy and gets the F out of there. The movie ends with a zoom on Candy's arm, where we see a little something-something growing on her arm and her shocked face in pure terror and a single tear coming down.
Maybe she does grow her own little children, or maybe she gets a real therapist who doesn't gaslight her and she's able to handle her emotions.
Yeah, that scene was so sad, just seeing like her, that little tear and just that manifestation and knowing that, kids pick up on so much. They are little sponges from the moment they're born, and so much stuff can just sit inside them and manifest in ways that you wouldn't think that they could. It's so sad to see that.
Also, this is a cycle. Like, Nola was becoming her mom. She was, in turn, abusing her daughter just like her mom abused her. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there's a theme of, like, nobody wants to turn into their parents.
Yeah.
You know, or they're like, or there's a fear of becoming like their parents, you know? And we could see with this end scene that Candy is on the path to becoming her mom.
Yeah, because her dad, they don't get into it. I want to believe her dad's going to be a great father, but he just killed his fucking ex-wife. That's going to leave a scar on him, and old JMB is just sitting back at the house for him, so who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah.
One of the things that I wanted to talk about in doing my research on this in relation to psychology, one of the search suggestions that I got was a Psychology Today article titled "The 7 Hidden Dangers of Brooding and Rumination." And that made me realize, like, oh yeah, like I had that oh yeah moment. Like, the word brood has more than one meaning. So, of course I looked it up. So, as a noun, basically the generic idea of what we see, like a family of young animals, like produced at birth. Brood is usually used to speak of birds. As a verb, brood means to think deeply about something that makes one unhappy. Brooding, like goths, emos, like the brooding
Jon
teenager,
Snow.
Brooding Jon Snow, Angel from Buffy. Oh god, the biggest brooders of them all. Or as a verb in relation to birds, it could mean to sit on and to hatch them, which is what Nola is doing. She is, mothering, creating, hatching these creatures. And as an adjective, it means to be kept to be used for breeding. And that is exactly what Raglan is doing to her. He is keeping her there for his own purposes to see how can I use Nola to fulfill my own theories of what this can produce? What can I breed from people? Nola seems to be my only subject to do this with. Let me use her. So the term brood has so many layers in this movie. I was so happy with the title once I looked up all these meanings of the term.
Not the original title of the film.
What was it?
I don't know. But Cronenberg had a different name for the film, and one of the producers changed it. Good choice to change it.
Wow.
But...
yeah. One more idea that I want to bring up before we close out. I was watching a YouTube video, and it was, you know, just talking about tulpas and everything. And one of the examples they brought up was Slender Man. One of the things that the narrator was saying, he was posing the question, you know, did the collective consciousness of millions of people who knew about, like, who knew the story about Slender Man create a Slender Man? Or has an entity answered the call of all of these people and taken the persona of Slender Man? So the idea that a tulpa cannot just be a manifestation of your own mind, but there is a being that is kind of just like in the background, kind of like observing, waiting, watching, and waiting for that opportunity to come forth and say, okay, now I'm here. And another interesting question that I couldn't really understand until this, we'll link the video in the show notes, but until this narrator had brought this to my mind, can a house be a tulpa? People talk about objects being tulpas, and I was like, well, how does that work? Think of Winchester, the idea that a house needs to constantly be built. A house is saying, like, you know, a house is dictating what needs to happen. Same thing as Haunting of Hill House. If anybody has seen the miniseries Rose Red, same concept. Can a house become a manifestation of all of these grievances or traumas? And I am just like going down like a rabbit hole of like what can be considered a tulpa, like shadow people. Can they be considered tulpas? Ghosts? Could that be, like, in some circumstances, can that be a tulpa created? So there are so many facets that are, like, just beginning to scratch the surface that I found really interesting. That it's like, yes, maybe these things that we don't understand, maybe they are manifestations of a collective consciousness. And we're just starting to scratch a surface. That's a very interesting concept.
See, I would say if tulpa, the whole tulpa thing was real, everything that we know that is paranormal or strange is a tulpa. Religious
maybe
things, everything.
I mean,
you see,
yeah.
An angel, no, it's a tulpa because there's so many people that believe in religion that you're manifesting it. The collective consciousness is going into the universe and bringing it out.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's all hodgepodge, you know?
Yeah, it's one of those things. It's like there are good arguments for it. And then it's like, well, it could just be, you know, like trying to make sense of what we're experiencing.
Yeah.
It's such an interesting, I guess, since it's newly brought into Western consciousness, it's now beginning to kind of manifest, I guess, become its own tulpa and manifest itself into our Western society.
I cannot wait to dive deeper into all of these ideas because I need to sit with everything that y'all had just brought up the past few minutes.
Yeah, it gets deep.
Well, let's rate this movie. Do you want to rate it on ski suits?
Yes.
Yes.
Unscary ski suits. Actually, Holly, I think you think ski suits are scary since Chicago did
they
rate this
are.
Movie the 88th scariest movie. I just think it's just a weird Chicago thing.
All right, Patrick.
All right.
How many ski suits you rate in this bad boy?
I'm giving this 2.5 ski suits. I think there's some great parts to this movie, but there's a lot of just dull, boring, slow parts. When I first watched this movie, I was 40 minutes in, and I was like, have I been here for 3 hours? Watching it the second time, I enjoyed it more, but I almost fast-forward parts, because I was like, I don't really learn anything from this, and whatever. I just want to get to the end to see with her giant placenta coming out of her stomach. The last 25 minutes of this movie really make up for a lot of it, but I also think there's a lot of parts in this movie where just reading reviews people looked deeply into and tried to pull something from when there was really nothing there to pull from. It's like, you know, when an English teacher tells you, the author made her shirt blue because of blah, blah, blah. And it's like, why don't you just make the shirt blue? Like, do we have to get so deep on something? Because Cronenberg's such a big director and he does do these thought-provoking things, people jump to that. But I don't think there was a lot of it in some of the parts of the movies people claim. So I give it 2.5 ski suits.
I'm going to give this 3 ski suits. There's a lot going on in this film. I thought it was well written. There's a lot of good quotes in this movie. Acting is great. Directing's good. It's definitely not that scary. It has body horror, but not like, oh my God, that's disgusting body horror. I would totally recommend to watch it. I did like it more the second time I watched it. The first time I was a little bored with it. I was like, huh, okay. But then, you know, reading up on it, getting some more insight and finding out more of the process and the inspiration behind the movie made me appreciate it a lot more. I would definitely check it out. But yeah, 3 super cozy, exciting ski suits.
I'm going to give it 4 ski suits. Maybe with a little cup of hot cocoa and a little marshmallow. But you know, I'm kind of sad I didn't see this pre-Holly with kids, because I'm so curious as to what I would have thought of it not having had kids. It really made a difference in how I viewed this and ultimately how I score it, because I got so much out of it. I was seeing this, I think, through the eyes of a parent, even though I'm nowhere near the situation of worrying what it would be like to have my children taken away. That can happen for any reason, you know, any weird reason that's made up at any point in time. You know, my kids can be taken away from me, and that's horrifying to think that I have no say in what happens in regards to that. You know, and then just, you know, the fear of carrying life and being a mother, and, you know, like, what is my offspring going to be? Like, what are they going to bring forth? You know, like, are they going to have that, like, positive nurturing energy, you know? And aside from, you know, the children aspect, the psychological parts of this really resonated with me. Having had such a long-lasting job in mental health, I see just, you know, so a variety of people come to our office for so many reasons, myriad of people. That also resonates with me, to know that, like, a person isn't good or bad. It's a culmination of things, you know? Like, you are not just automatically, like, your collective of what has come before you, what goes on with you at the present moment, what your hopes are for the future. It's a whole collective. And to see that portrayed in the fear of losing your child, it was pretty awesome to see this. And, you know, Patrick, like you said, it was kind of boring at times, but I personally didn't mind it, because I think I had more stake in it than you did, so I can tolerate those downtimes to, okay, like, I want to stick this out and, like, see what their dialogue is, rather than feeling like, all right, I know what's coming.
Yeah, if I started growing broods, they better be fucking ready to pay rent when they come out. I ain't supporting them. But that's the brood.
Yeah.
That's the brood. Thank you guys for listening and hopefully subscribing to us. Please check out our website, beyondthescreams.com, for resources to what we mentioned on this episode. Also, please check out our Facebook group and our Facebook page, Beyond the Screams. Follow us on Instagram at beyond_the_screams_podcast, and Twitter at beyond_screams. Also, join us on our Discord on December 11th, this Friday. We're going to play some fun drinking games and talk about some Christmas horror movies. It's going to be a good time.
Yeah, come hang out
with us. DJ Party Dad will be there.
Yes, he will. He has nothing else to do.
Also, you know, check out our Patreon. We're giving out some cool content.
We now have stickers and we're working on t-shirts.
Yes.
So if you want some stickers, go to our website and contact us. Maybe subscribe or tag us on Instagram and maybe we'll send you some stickers. And also, next Monday, we'll have a nice Christmas tale for everyone. So be sure to check us out on our next episode as well.
They come from the unknown, and they're here now, hiding, waiting to strike. You can feel their presence all around you. Never before have you come this close to the edge of terror. Never before have you faced anything so strange and sinister, so bizarre and unnerving. Never until now. David Cronenberg's The Brood.